This is the Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. I'm your host, Gary McGraw, CTO of Cigital and author of Software Security. This podcast series is co-sponsored by Cigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine, where a portion of this interview will appear in print in a future issue. For more, see www.computer.org/security and www.cigital.com/silverbullet. This is the 20th in a series of interviews with security gurus, and I'm very pleased to have with me here today Marcus Jacobson. Hi, Marcus.
Hi, Gary. How are you?
Marcus Jacobson is soon to be a researcher at Park in Silicon Valley. He's leaving Indiana University, where he was an associate professor of informatics and associate director of the Center for Applied Cybersecurity Research. His PhD is from UC San Diego, and in past lives, he's worked at the San Diego Supercomputing Center, Bell Labs, and RSA Labs, where he was principal research scientist. Marcus writes very heavy books, including Phishing and Countermeasures and the upcoming Crimeware. Together with his wife, Sukaman Srikwan, Marcus produces the website securitycartoon.com and a little boy. Marcus's distinctive hairstylings originate in Thailand. So, in your career so far, you've been a researcher at Bell Labs and RSA Labs and soon to be Park, and an academic at Indiana University. Now you're going to go back to corporate research. What's the difference?
The main difference, as I see it, is that in corporate research, you don't have to worry so much about the funding. Although I might be mistaken, given the way things are going these days. But there's a lot of freedom, at least in the places that I've been, and it isn't too different from the academic life. A couple of fewer committees and a little bit less grants to worry about, but then other things to do, of course, like patent applications. But largely, the core is the same.
How about teaching? Any teaching when you did the research jobs at the other two places?
Well, I was teaching at NYU, New York University, while I was at RSA, and I really appreciate teaching. It's fun, and I haven't scheduled something for the year to come or something like that, because moving takes quite a heavy toll on you, and you know, starting a new job does too, of course. So taking it a little bit easy and not getting involved in teaching the first year is probably a good plan, but after that, I think I will.
I know you've also branched out a little bit into entrepreneurial work with Raven White, and
yes,
I was
correct.
Wondering whether you think that your propensities in that direction are different than many academics, or has working in one of these labs helped you to see what can happen with a little startup and made you interested in that?
It, of course, given me an interest in getting things deployed, and that's the reason why I was attracted to corporate life in the beginning, because everybody wants to see what they're doing change the world in some way,
mm-hmm.
and I'm not an exception. And that's why as I left for academia, I wanted to remain in a position to be able to have that kind of influence, not only on people's minds, but also on products. And that's a possibility I'll be able to keep as I'm moving to Park, and that's very nice.
That's good. So your thesis long ago was titled Privacy Versus Authenticity. That's sort of a controversial title, I suppose. What was the thrust of that work?
This was written during the years of perfect privacy of payment schemes. In the cryptographic community, there was a belief that you need a payment scheme that has this ultimate and perfect privacy.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just not a firm believer of that. I could see the horrendous abuses that could arise from it. And I saw that there's a necessity for balancing this. Now, of course, today, things are balanced out the other way with actual payment schemes deployed. There isn't much privacy at all. So you could actually head in the direction of privacy, and it would improve the situation.
So are you saying that your thesis actually killed off privacy?
I can't quite say that. But what I mean to say is that during those years, during which I wrote my thesis, there was the belief that you needed the perfect privacy. And there was just not a lot of discussion about privacy that you could revoke in case of abuse.
Mm-hmm.
And so it started just with the moral belief that you have to be able to. And then I went through the mathematical exercises of making it possible in a way that you could only do it under certain circumstances that are well defined and so on. And that was the thrust of my thesis.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Do you think there is such a thing as privacy in the modern world, or do you agree with Scott McNeely?
you know, there could have been privacy, but people sell it. People sell their own privacy at such a low price that it's remarkable. Not even aware of that they're doing it most of the time, but it's happening. And, of course, you and I can't be the only people out there who want privacy, because we'd get privacy in a crowd of two people. So we need everybody to get a little bit more aware of the benefits. A lot of people would say, why would I need privacy? I'm not a criminal. But that's a change of mindset that is needed to say that, well, wait a minute, if I get a larger degree of privacy and I cannot be abused as a result. For example, take phishing, spear phishing, or what really means targeted phishing. That's a result of lack of privacy. The phisher could learn details about you that allows them to target you better because he knows your information. More privacy would mean less spear phishing. And so you could see it in that context, too, that there's a need for privacy.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that there's a fundamental trade-off between security and privacy?
I really don't. I think of them as being different names for the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
The security is just a general statement that you cannot be abused. And privacy would be to say, well, your information that you don't want to be leaked cannot be abused. And so it's just naming convention, really.
Mm-hmm. You've focused a lot of your current work on the interface between security and actual people, arguably two non-intersecting sets. So what prompted the move from hardcore cryptography into sociology?
Maybe the realization that hardcore cryptography is not going to change the world. You know, it's wonderful with mathematics, and I enjoy it a lot, but I enjoy it as kind of exercise and not as a way of changing the world. If you really want security to happen, you need to realize that it's not enough with the algorithm, but you also need to present information to the user and make sure that they can understand it. And so a lot of my work recently has been about user experiments to see how do people react to various interfaces and to various kinds of information, and can people understand it? And then you could fold that back in several ways into security. You could say, well, then I could tell the trends if I know the vulnerabilities. And second, you could say, well, I could tell what user interface actually works, because the first one has no impact on security. People don't look at it, or they don't understand how to use it, whereas the second one does.
Yeah, but of course the problem is that people do really surprising and shockingly silly things sometimes.
Yeah, but that has to be taken into consideration. It's far too common to say, oh man, people are dumb, and you know, anybody who does something that dumb should suffer the consequences. But you cannot base security in an open society on such a statement.
Sure.
You need to say, look, people are going to continue to do things that to me are remarkably dumb, but that's because to them it makes no sense to think about, you know, SSL certificates and, you know, what have you. But they just need to go on with their lives.
And so... Now, so even though P.T. Barnum said there's a sucker born every minute, you still believe that there's some real hope to combating phishing?
Well, that sucker could be your mom or my mom, and I don't want either to be had. Now, of course, phishing is not only about technology, and it's not only about user interfaces. It's also about user education. If you want to educate people, what can you educate them about? What is a meaningful campaign? Those are questions that all go back to how do people understand security? And so you started by saying that now I'm in sociology, and I would disagree. I would instead say I care about the practical instantiations of security.
Oh, that sounds like sociology.
It does, but it's always tied to the technology. You know, it always goes back to, okay, so what should we compute and what should we present? And, you know, it ties back into cookies on people's computers using various technologies. It goes back into what is the computation needed?
Mm-hmm.
Is there any digital certificates? What is the presented material? These are the kind of things that are the bottom line.
Right. So you have to have that interface. I think the key is the interface.
Yes. But also, this is not about surveys and sitting people down and interviewing them. Much of the time, if you want to understand fraud and phishing, you need to go out, unfortunately, and do it to people. And the reason is, if I say to you, now look at these things, which one is phishing? You'll look at the world in a very different way than if you're just being posed with a problem during your normal life.
I know. That's why I never click on any links that you send me, no matter what.
It's a good idea. You know, when I send something to my wife, she walks over to my office and said, did you send it?
So and then if you did, she doesn't click on it.
Absolutely.
Strangely, that seems backwards. So you know, some phishing systems have evolved to be spectacularly sophisticated. And it might be useful to explain one of the most interesting phishing attacks that you've come across so people have a feeling of how this works.
I'm always impressed by phishing attacks that seem psychologically convincing, whether it's because of targeting or because the material that they present that just seems so right to whoever reads it.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a couple of them that I like for their insight of the fisher, and they could have been great academics, or they could have worked on better countermeasures had they chosen to, but they took the criminal path. I also have collections of, you could call them synthetical phishing emails, things that I have developed and tested in a lab or in a phishing experiment environment and concluded that this would have worked wonders, and why am I in this career anyway when I could have made 10 times, you know? I'll give you an example of one that is synthetic, because it's clear how it has an impact. Many times when you get an email from your bank, they will say, and this is for your account ending in 4770 or something like mm-hmm. that. And you look at your credit card and you say, yes, that's my credit card or something like that. And so that's called mutual authentication. They will authenticate themselves to you in this email before they ask you to log in and authenticate yourself to them by your PIN. And that's, of course, intended as an anti-phishing technique.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we've tested this in various environments. We've given people emails that, instead of saying this is your last four, they said these are your first four digits.
Mm-hmm.
So it might say this is for your account starting with 4220.
Mm-hmm.
And to people, there's absolutely no security difference to people. You know, they look at their card and say, yeah, my card starts with 4220. That's fine. Then I'm speaking to my bank. It has to be. But that's not the case. The first four digits correspond to the issuer. It means if you're with Chase Bank, I know what the four first digits are, for example. Or if you're with First USA and they've issued a credit card, then I know the same with a very good likelihood.
Mm-hmm.
And that means as a fisher, if I were a fisher, I would just say, here are your first four because I am from such and such institution.
Right.
And you will look at this and you'll say, yes, of course you are. Now, that means that authenticating yourself by the last four is an insane thing to do, because you're teaching all your users that, you know, four digits, that's okay. And then when the fisher comes around and says the first four, you know, the guy is hooked.
Yeah, they fall right in the hole.
Absolutely. So you're setting yourselves up for a miserable landing.
So the real question is, you know, if you're sufficiently skeptical, let's say that you've been subscribing to securitycartoon.com's RSS feed for years, and you understand phishing attacks pretty deeply, can banks even send you legitimate email anymore? Or is that whole path cut off now?
You know, there's some pretty remarkable things going on. A little bit more than a year ago, there was a campaign, a phishing campaign that people referred to as the Chase Rewards. Lots of people got spam that said, this is Chase Bank, and you could earn $25 by answering this easy survey.
Mm-hmm.
And you just have to click in some answers, and it was very easy. And then, of course, to collect the $25, you have to give your account number. And, and you know, this is one of my other favorites, and this is a real example.
Mm-hmm.
And then when it didn't quite work anymore, then you started seeing emails that said you get $50, and, you know, the same thing. And the cost increased in order to get more and more people hooked on this.
Mm-hmm.
Now, about half a year ago, there was a real email, legitimate email, from Discover credit cards that said, please take part in this quick and easy survey, and they offered some rewards.
Nobody clicked on it?
I'm sure people did, but this is the most remarkable thing. Instead of fishers mimicking reality, you have reality seemingly mimicking fishers. How bad could it get?
That's really funny. So you can't feel bad for falling for it in many cases, because sometimes legitimate traffic looks exactly like that.
Absolutely. And when you talk to people in these companies, if they're people in the security division, they will either be outraged or embarrassed or terrified or something like that. But most of the time, they can do very little, because they're not the ones crafting these emails. The emails are sent by the people in the PR division.
Right, right.
And they have no security background.
Right.
So it's really a communication problem of a kind.
Mm-hmm. You recently chaired the e-crime conference in Pittsburgh, which was a fun thing to go to because I was there.
That was a great conference.
What was the most startling thing that you learned at that conference?
The session I thought was the most fun, apart from yours, of course, was the session about political phishing.
Ah.
Most people think of phishing as something that mimics your bank and or a bank that you don't even know about, and then you would immediately know that it's a phishing attack. And it asks you to log in within 24 hours or something like that. But a political phishing attack instead mimics one out of the two parties. So they got a pretty good chance at getting your party. And they say, please ask, please contribute today. You know, you don't have to contribute a lot, just $1 today, and to show that you're behind me. And, of course, the recipient might agree that a dollar is not a big deal and decide to log in. But when they log in, and it seems like they're contributing by PayPal or by a credit card, they're really visiting the Fisher site. And they are, of course, giving out their credentials. Now, this is such an elegant way of defrauding people, both because it's targeted without even knowing your affiliation, whether you're Republican or Democrat, you've got a very good chance. And secondly, the allure is there because, you know, there's political campaign racing going on all the time. Politicians rely on it to such a remarkable extent that the internet is flooded with it.
And now that we're moving into the election season.
Absolutely. So that's the absolutely the next relevant place for fishers to go. You know, mimic reality.
Yeah, the thing that I was surprised the most about at that conference was I'd always thought there was money laundering in those MMORPGs that I talk about. And I met a guy who told me that, in fact, there was, and it was a guy from the Secret Service, and they were tracking a few cases, which was really interesting.
But it's nice to know. It's not a surprising thing to me either because, you know, you got cover of a game. How bad could you be?
You're doing this
for fun, right? But at the same time, there's an amazing opportunity for funds transfers.
Have you known of any phishing attacks that were trying to get gaming credentials out of people?
Yeah, but I couldn't tell you on the spot what they were. There have been a few that very much mimic normal phishing scams. They might offer you a new shield or something like that if you log in. And mostly they didn't know that you're playing a given game because, after all, they've got access to the bulletin boards where you might have posted something.
Right, right. So you've been busy working on another Too Heavy to Carry tome. I think the title of this one is Crimeware.
Yes.
What evolution have we seen in crimeware from the really early days of, say, Blaster and the I Love You Worms?
Well, I'd like to take a step back and talk about the very early viruses. You know, one of the first few viruses, they were transmitted maybe by floppy drive or something like that.
Sneakernet, we called it back.
Exactly. And so they had a physical carrier. And later on, of course, it moved on to being attachments and things like that, like the Melissa virus was transported by email. And now what you're seeing is that it's more and more installed by the user. The user thinks that he's installing a game, but he isn't. He's installing, you know, after all, a game that is malware too. Or he thinks that he's watching a porn flick, but he's not. He's watching a porn flick and installing malware.
Right.
Things like that. Right. And a student of mine and I, we performed very interesting experiments on people's willingness to install anything on their machines if their friend said it was cool. So we had a little funny movie that we changed the executable of, in order to count how many people arrived to the site where it's hosted and the number of people who downloaded it. And we replaced the real certificate, which was a thought certificate, by a self-signed certificate, which should have scared people off, especially since the text that we wrote there was not very confidence-inspiring. And lots of people downloaded it. What we did was we forwarded it to 20 friends or so, not telling them what it was.
This is why I just don't read your email anymore.
Absolutely, yeah. Gary. And they forwarded it, all but you, I think, to their friends and said, this is really cool, and it went
on. I really didn't. I won't take any email from from Marcus.
It's a good idea, but you also have to be careful about everybody I know and everybody who knows somebody I know and so on. We were on five continents.
That's why we were happy to have you trapped in Indiana.
That's a good thing.
Now you're escaping to California.
No, but we were on five continents within a couple of hours because of these forwarded. And, in fact, more than 50% of the people who received such a crazy invitation to look at and install an unknown executable with a cell sign certificate took the opportunity. And so that is the trend, more and more user involvement. And at the same time, you got the trend of instead of playing a practical joke on the recipient, actually extracting something that is worth money to the crimeware author. And that's, of course, why you call it crimeware, because it's there for a reason.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, it's kind of striking to look at the difference even in the pictures of people who wrote viruses 10 years ago versus how they look now.
It's organized crime.
It is organized crime, and you see their pictures, and you just go, holy cow.
I know.
Those people don't look very nice at all.
Yes. And some of the best places, really, to contract one of these bad things is free file sharing things, because how do you know that the claimed MP3 that you're downloading really is an MP3, and it's not an executable that, when you double-click on it, will install or something like that?
Yeah, exactly.
Now, you might argue that, but I will get the interface that says, are you sure you want to do this? But most people always click yes.
Yeah, there's some pretty funny social engineering things with cell phone malware, too, where if you're getting a Bluetooth attack from the Kaber virus, it'll say, do you want to install this? And you say no, and then it sends a new copy and says, do you want to install this? And you say no, and you keep on clicking no until you finally get exasperated and click yes just because it's rebroadcasting to you all the time.
And that's what people do.
They sure
and it
do.
Doesn't take many tries, really, to get people to say, well, you know, I want to do other things than clicking on buttons today. So
like
I
maybe
might
make
as well
a call.
Exactly.
So you published a paper on cartoons recently. Academia. So why cartoons?
Cartoons is one of the ways that you could reach people. And so if you've got an educational message and you want people to change their behavior, really, writing a thick textbook like the books we've been talking about, that's for fellow researchers. But if you want to reach the majority of people out there and you want them to change their way of doing things, cartoons are really the way to go. You need to chop things up into 30-second messages. You know, this is not an insult, but you want to be able to reach people and say something meaningful in such a short time, or otherwise you lose the opportunity.
Right.
Because they're not there to get educated. They're there to, you know, do their stuff.
So everybody should go check out securitycartoon.com. There's no S in there. And see what Marcus and his wife have come up with, because it's pretty interesting stuff. So the last question is a really important one. If our listeners are ever in Thailand and they desperately need a haircut, where should they go?
I got a favorite place, but you know, I'm never going anywhere alone because I'd be lost immediately. So I'd have to call my wife and ask for direction. I'm sorry about this.
So if you need a haircut and you're going to Thailand, you have to bring your wife.
Absolutely. It's somewhere in Bangkok, but and there are nice restaurants in the neighborhood. But you know, that doesn't limit it down a whole lot.
Maybe you can ask your wife and we'll put a URL up for
that's
that.
That's possible. But may I add that this is a piece of information that you know because it's on my wiki, and my wiki is not self-authored. This is added by students of mine who happen to learn this and other information. And some of this information is actually not factual. So just as a disclaimer.
Yeah, well, you know, if we want, we can look at your official picture and then we can tell that it's definitely Thailand. Where
you could absolutely, yeah.
Oh, great. Thanks a lot, Marcus.
Thank you, Gary.
This has been a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. The November-December 2007 issue of IEEE S&P Magazine features an article by Marcus titled Web Camouflage, Protecting Your Clients from Browser Sniffing Attacks. Silver Bullet is co-sponsored by Cigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine, where Silver Bullet excerpts are published in every issue. Subscribe today at www.computer.org/security/BSI-sub. Show links, notes, and an online discussion can be found on the Silver Bullet webpage at www.cigital.com/silverbullet. This is Gary McGraw.